NBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends, and welcome to the Truth and Justice Friday follow-up for episode 59, Moore's Closing. We are without our dear and wonderful Zach today. He is a bit under the weather, so we are all wishing him well. And so we're going to take a quick break, and then Bob and I will be back to answer your listener questions.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, thanks everybody for joining us today. As I'm sure Janet mentioned in the intro, we are sans Zach today. He's not even on an assignment today. He is Zach's a little under the weather, doesn't have a voice and couldn't make it. But Janet and I are gonna push through.
And yeah.
Today's episode of which show are we doing today?
This is Truth and Justice.
That's the one. Yeah, the Truth and Justice. Sorry, getting a little mix ups. Real quick before we get into the episode and all your questions, which we're going to do. I do want to address just out of transparency and mild irritation on my part. I do want to address something that was brought up on the fan page, as is typical when we come up with an episode that has some new evidence in it. There's a group of folks that try to derail the conversation away from that and to another direction. But of course, and I was accused of being biased and not presenting the state's case and all that. So I want to address it here. There was a group that got together on one page and then came over on our page to point out the fact that Christian the claim was that Christian lied in his first interview because he claimed that he didn't know Becky was dead, and they had cropped out and screenshot a small portion of that interview where Michael says, well, you know, he's talking about, you know, why they're there, and he goes, Becky, you know she's dead, right? And Christian says, no, Robert had, and then he kind of tails off, and then that's the part in the interview. You can go back and read the transcript where Michael's telling him, like, I know this is nerve-wracking, but calm down, do all that stuff. And so it, anyway, if you're on the fan page, you saw there's like this huge thread where everybody debating whether Christian did know that Becky was dead or not. And they pointed out that John earlier in the interview before Christian was there had said that, that he had seen the tragedy is the way he puts it in the paper. And Christian had told him, they know that girl, that's Robert's ex-girlfriend, and that they had plans. His dad says that they had plans to go to a barbecue or something up there, that day. And so they said, you know, with those things together, since the interview was on the 28th. On the 27th was the day that her body was finally identified, and then that was put out to the public. There's a newspaper article on the 27th that said that her body had been identified. So putting those together, they said there's no way that that Robert or that Christian didn't know Becky was dead because his dad saw the paper. Now, granted, there were lots of newspaper articles over the course of those 10 days. About the case. His dad said he had been out of town and he came back and was looking at the papers. We don't even know which paper he was looking at. But of course, Becky and John and Vicky's pictures were in most of those articles. But so the claim was made, and several people said that this is one of the reasons they think Christian is guilty, because why would he lie to them and say that he didn't know Becky was dead? I want to address that, because what they didn't tell you, or what they cropped out of that page, was the rest of Christian's answer. After the calm down and everything, Christian says, Michael's asked, like, what do you know about it? And Christian says, I know there was a fire. I know there was three people dead. There were two people that were in the house. And then there was one body that was, he says, in a dumpster or something. is what he says. And then he says what he had started to say earlier was, last I heard from Robert, they hadn't identified the body yet, that you guys didn't know who was there yet, but I'm guessing you know now.
Mm.
So that was the full context of that. So if you were to read that, you would see me saying, like, this is nothing. He didn't lie and say he didn't know Becky was dead. He didn't even say he didn't know Becky was dead. What he said was he knew three people had died.
Mm-hmm.
He knew two were in the house. He knew one was outside, he thinks, in a dumpster. And he thought that the body hadn't been identified yet. And then Michaels tells him, yes, it has been identified yet. So out of full transparency, because I don't want to be biased, I want to make sure to point out that I saw that, had the conversation. And if you want to read the transcript, go read Christian's transcript from September 28th. So when you see the claims that Christian lied and said he didn't know Becky was dead, what Christian actually said was that he knew there were people dead, didn't know that they had officially identified the body yet. So I just wanted to make sure to cover that before we move on to this episode, to make sure that we're covering everything.
Got it.
Because again, that was, and we're going to move on, but I will point out, you know, I had conversations in that thread with people who claimed that my entire investigation has been biased because I haven't presented the case. I've asked them what have I not presented. I've literally presented the entire prosecution's case. We've now, as of this coming Sunday, will have presented the entire trial, all the documents out there. At one point, I asked this specific person, what things do you want me to cover that you think I haven't covered that make them look guilty? We covered that. I've also invited anyone to come on and make the case for guilt. And so then I was told that because Robert's mom, Kathleen, one time in one of these chats, did a super chat for $5 or $4.99 for us, which was really nice of Kathleen to do. And I was told that clearly that was my motivation for committing the last year and a half of my life to this case. It was all hoping that Kathleen would buy me a cup of coffee, which finally happened last week. So there's my bias. I'll stop being snarky. You only can listen to so much bullshit before you just got to call people out on their bullshit. And with that being said, Janet, what'd you think about Moore's closing argument?
I liked it. I'm interested. You know, there were some folks who, and I sort of put this first in the follow-up order. There were some folks who, you know, in the episode, you do say, and you said it, I think, in last week's follow-up, that you weren't necessarily a huge fan of Moore's mm-hmm. approach, but there was a lot of really interesting information in there. Yeah. Valeria very astutely had discovered just prior to you covering Moore's closing that the lighter had been found, was in evidence, at least was listed in evidence, along with some other stuff that you get into in this episode. But so there were some folks who walked away, like Keith and Liz and Alex, who kind of liked the closing and were maybe interested to hear a little bit more from you on why you had such a strong reaction to it in the slightly more negative category.
To be clear, I don't have an issue at all with the entirety of Moore's closing. What I didn't care for was the presentation of the imaginary scenario. And the reason was, really, that's to me, it's fair is fair. I've called out the state for creating scenarios that weren't supported by the evidence. And so and that's what Moore did in a couple of instances, right? So he tried to fit a scenario together that fit the evidence, but then he also filled in like, you know, Becky called Robert on Monday. Well, we don't know if Becky called Robert on Monday. We don't have he says from the home phone. He said that specifically because we don't have the home phone records from that day and we don't have Robert's records from that day. So there's no way to prove that happened. That was my only issue, was that first segment where he gave the imaginary scenario. After that, I think he made some really good points. And truthfully, the part that I thought that was the most brilliant, probably a strong word, but it was a great strategy, was the way he handled Jeremy Witt, rather than just saying, like, this guy's full of shit, don't listen to him, like, he's not credible, he's not trustworthy. I think that Moore accurately picked up on the fact that no one probably believed Witt. And so he spends a lot of, and if you read that, I talked about it, but if you read the transcript, you'll see he spends a fair amount of time driving home the fact that Jeremy Witt is a linchpin of the state's case. You know, so he kind of, it's kind of a set him up and knock him down scenario where he's, you know, he's saying, listen, they have to have Jeremy Witt in order to have a case. If you don't believe Jeremy Witt, then they don't have a case. You have to, he's crucial to their case. And then moves on to say, and here's all the reasons why you can't believe Jeremy Witt. I thought that was well done. So yeah, the second half of his closing, I did like. I didn't like the first part. That said, I think that, I don't know if he had much of an option outside of that.
Because
the state presented a scenario. So like you have to present
who's got the best story
scenario. And he was handcuffed by the fact that he couldn't name any alternate suspects.
Yeah.
In his closing. So there wasn't a lot much more he would do. For me, I did like Dolan's approach better, which was just really hammering away like these things are not proven. They're telling you things happened that aren't proven by the evidence.
Yeah, I know I just interrupted you and I apologize for that, but just the whole who tells the best story, you know, we've talked about it so much on the podcast in general. And so I wasn't necessarily expecting a story to be told, a scenario to be given that could help paint a picture that would at least pull focus off of the story that the state told. So I had mixed feelings about it because I felt like I would probably feel compelled to do the same thing. I mean, just because I do feel like we kind of have an understanding that, you know, you can't just say they didn't prove their case, that people want to have a narrative. And so he did provide some kind of a narrative. The problem was that maybe it wasn't the best narrative. And like you said, he was also not able to say a lot of things that I'm sure could have helped that. But I just want to really quickly shout out SL on the chat, because just to circle back very quickly to the idea of bias, you know, we've had people coming from the opposite direction. SL says, I know people were complaining on previous seasons for the emotional pulls on them. And so early on, you had kind of made a decision not to publish a bunch of stuff that could be accused of tugging at people's heartstrings. And so now we're coming towards the end of the season. And in fact, you could actually argue there's an absence of bias in that you haven't given the human beings behind what's happened who are in prison the same kind of voice that maybe you have in past seasons. So just to kind of counterbalance the bias idea, there have also been folks who are like, I want to hear more about the guys. I want to know them better now that we have talked about the evidence and the facts. And so I know there's been a lot of interest in that. And so SL brings that back up now.
Yeah. And that's coming. We're working on trying to do an interview with the guys, at least Robert. You know, the two guys have two different legal teams that have two different views on how they should interact with media. So there's a lot of that's up in the air, but we're working on something like that. But there's definitely some family interviews and some people from the family that people are going to hear from. I also want to point out from the chat, Montana makes a good point, and I agree with her. She says, I think it was problematic that Dolan stressed the importance of presenting the evidence rather than telling a story divorced from the evidence, but then Moore comes up right after and tells a fantastical story.
Absolutely. Could not agree more, Montana. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah. And I'll tell you that in what we're going to get this week, which is the state's rebuttal, Aki caught onto that as well. And the other part about the issue I have with the narrative approach that Moore took too is I think what you run the risk of is, if you say something that the jury doesn't buy, then I think it affects your credibility.
Sure.
You know, like even like, you know, and I mentioned that in Dolan's too, when Dolan talks about the garage door, like, you know, after Tim left, then he came back and then put accelerant on the body and lit it on fire again. And then went in and closed the garage door. I always worried, like, if the jury is like, that sounds like nonsense, then will they think the rest of it is nonsense too?
Right. Okay. So let's move into some specifics from the Facebook post. Speaking of the cell stuff that comes up in this episode, Kristen says, can you explain what you meant about the cell tower being connected to the guard device? I was very confused.
It's guard device. Hopefully I got that right. I think I did. the device, they talk about it in Gillette's testimony. He talks about what it is and how it works. It's a device made by Gladiator, I believe. And it's a device that's connected to the car and computers and stuff, that's what they use to drive around when they're driving around to the drive test to gather all the data. But it was, and I had never considered until Moore said that. And then also back from my conversations with Mike Dowd, our expert, and then other experts that I've talked to that weren't able to come on and do interviews, where they said all the time, like, different phones have different, like, you can have two phones right next to each other and one will connect to one tower and one will connect to a different one because, you know, they have different external antennas, they have different internal antennas. And that got me thinking when Moore brought that up, that these drive tests were done, like, when they show they could find these tiny little spots where 523 could catch some coverage on 74. That was from the guard device, which from what I was able to find online, looks like they're like external antennas that are on the car. And then it got me wondering, well, so that was able, you know, something that might have a 12-inch external antenna could maybe make a connection to that tower from 8 miles away, but could, you know, a Nokia with a 1-inch antenna inside the car make that same connection? And I'm not saying it can't. I'm saying we don't know because that wasn't done. And to be honest, the entire drive tests that were done are problematic, in my opinion, shouldn't have been allowed to begin with because they were done 10 years later. You know, they said Verizon says basically the towers, everything is essentially the same. First of all, I don't think that's entirely true. Mm. Second of all, you know, even if nothing changed with the towers, what did change for sure was the phones that are connecting to the tower, buildings around the towers, construction. There's all these different things that have changed, you know, over the 12 years between when the crime happened and when the Gladiator report was done and made. I don't see how, when I think back on it, how is that even allowed to be used as evidence? You can't say, you know, I checked the cell coverage in an area 12 years later, and that's what we're going to use to prove where these guys were at. That's crazy to me that they were able to do that. So, and then even think, like, in 2006, 3G was just coming out, right? That a 3G signal. By 2018, 4G, you know, their 4G LTE was, they're different signal. I don't see how they can say nothing changed. Something changed.
Right.
The types of signals that were coming off those towers have changed. And I don't, and again, I'm not an expert, so I don't know. Maybe those have the exact same range and everything between a 3G and a 4G or LTE or now 5G. But it seems very, very strange to me that was even allowed in.
Oh, I was just going to ask if the defense brought up any of that.
I think just what you saw in the closing, the fact that there was no phones ever used. But and that gets back to the root of the question. That's what I meant was, right, you know, they were driving around with a device connected to a car, not driving around with a phone in a car.
I mean, you would think that would come up in cross when they were actually speaking to when that part of the trial was happening.
Yeah, and it may, I'd have to go back and review the testimony is up on our website, but I'd have to go back and review the testimony. My guess is if it came up in cross, they may have just asked the question, did you ever use a phone or anything like that? But I don't recall that because I say that because it jumped out at me when I was reading Moore's closing when he said it. I'm like, oh my God, like, besides, and Chris in the chat mentions too, like, on top of that, like, traffic patterns, growth, everything changed over that time, which is exactly right. But then it jumped out at me that, yeah, they had never used phones. So I don't know how, and by the way, that can be the same for Bodmer's drive test. How in the hell do they take a drive test done 12 years after the fact to tell you how long it would have taken in a different vehicle with a different driver, how they were able to allow to use that to tell the jury how long it would have taken Robert and Christian in an Acura 12 years earlier to make that drive? That's bananas too. I don't get how any of that was allowed.
And that would have been a pretrial. The lawyers would have said, like, Your Honor, we argue that you can't even admit this in. You shouldn't be allowed to do this. Which makes me wonder, like just in general. I mean, you don't always hear about this in cases, but certainly in cases where people have taken a hard look at, and when there's been, you know, tape of or in-depth conversations about things like the OJ trial or something, people do talk about the preferences or the preferential treatment that some people perceive was shown to the prosecution or to the defense in those various cases. And so that's not something we really talked about much for this case, but just those little moments that build up if it's, you know, if you can see that a judge is kind of showing preferential treatment to the prosecution.
Yeah.
In terms of where the injections and sustainings and all those sort of things happen.
Yeah. And I know that in this case, you know, there was a lot of the defense took a lot of L's in pretrial, you know, one of them being alternate suspects. You know, they were fighting to be allowed to bring up alternate suspects, and they just got shot down by the judge.
Right. Carrie says there has been a lot of talk of phone calls made. Do we know if Robert or Christian tried to call Becky's cell phone after the fire to help look for her? I'm assuming kind of along the same lines as like Adnan never called Hay again, you know, that kind of argument,
right?
Maybe. Even if her cell was destroyed in the house, her voicemail would still be active within the carrier system.
Yeah, no, there's no records of Robert ever trying to call her. I think, so remember the Robert's first, in a world where Robert's innocent, his first word he knew that there was any issue. So again, I'm not asking you to believe he's innocent, but just imagine it for this scenario that he had nothing to do with this. So that would mean that he spent Sunday night with her blowing up his phone and him ignoring all of her calls. And then he gets up in the morning, and then the first call he gets is from Javier telling him, like, there was a fire, there's all this going on, I can't get a hold of her, I'm going up there. Goes up there, and he's getting all the updates from Javier that there's people dead and her car's there, so on and so forth. That would be, if in a world where Robert was innocent, that would be where things would stand with him, and he didn't make any calls. Now, that said, Javier, after that, I think did still try to make calls. And I think he'd said at one point that he just wanted to hear her voice on the voicemail. And I think even Jacob tried. Well, Jacob is a little different because Jacob was calling her. He just got like some information from Javier, didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And then he started calling Becky looking for her during that day. But no, the short answer to the question is no, Robert never tried to call her after that.
Okay. Let's get into the hair and the lighter. Chris says, was the area where the green lighter was found photographed the night of the murder? Could this really have been missed? Family, friends, and neighbors must have been all over the scene in the week since this info was found.
I have not seen any photos of the lighter even in place where it was found. It's just another, like, the report says it was at the intersection of the driveway and Alpine Drive, northwest of there on the Freedley property, is where this lighter was found. There's a file of pictures that are, their title is like Pablo and Sifting Through Scene or whatever. And that's where these photos were found. And like, we see one picture of the lighter and it's like set on a piece of paper or something to take a picture, but they never photographed it in place. So I don't know where it was found. But that's a good point. It'd be worth it because there are some pictures out at the end of the driveway of like the fire trucks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Be interesting to see if it's out there, but there's no way to know, you know, if we had a photo showing like it's right there, then absolutely we could go look at some of those pictures and find that exact spot. But all we know is it was somewhere over there. So we don't really know where it was at. Did they ask something about the hair too, or is it just the lighter they were asking about?
This is just my section of, you know, questions that came in that I organized that have to do with either the hair or the lighter or both. Tracy says, did anyone say if they found footprints on the north side of the house where the hair and lighter were found? They made such a big deal about the footprints going out into the desert where the wheelbarrow track was, but I can't remember if they said anything about any other prints around the back of the house.
No, and remember, that's what we've been complaining about since the beginning, is there's a path from that back porch or the back door, which is where, one, where the back door is, and two, the area where was kind of the escape route. That was planned out, that we heard about from Drew, where they would escape. But that would also come down on that back porch. There's a bay window right there that they use as kind of a step to get down from the roof if they, you know, went out the upstairs window. And there's a path directly from that back door to directly where the body in the wheelbarrow was found. And we have no pictures of that path, you know. Now, granted, there's a lot of firefighter tracks and stuff in there, but we have, like, it was never searched for evidence. They never used luminol, nothing to look for blood, nothing along that. So there were tracks all over the place from the firefighters.
Right.
So, you know, after the fact, I don't think footprints would be super helpful in that area. But obviously, if you found a pair of, you know, tennis shoe prints, not fire boots, that would be worth noting, at least. My issue with that was always, like, at least go through that area and spray luminol and see if you can find any blood. But they didn't.
Right. Kristen says, could the hair on lighter have been tested, but the results weren't shared with the defense?
I'd hate to speculate on that. I mean, anything's possible. And if that was the case, then that would obviously be a massive, massive Brady violation. But I don't see any evidence that they do. Someone had mentioned to me, that there was a clump of hair found in a brush, in a hairbrush, mm-hmm. I think from one of the cars that they had taken, were going to test to use for DNA to try to ID Vicky's body. But it wasn't used for that. So I need to track that down and figure that out. But this was not hair on a brush. This was just, like, somewhere north in the north side of the house was this clump of hair. That's all we know. And I have no record of it ever being tested.
Okay. Well, Kim had followed up and mentioned the Brady possibility and even said, can the prosecution not proceeding with testing items that could have been exculpatory grounds be grounds for an appeal?
No, not unless they're, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is it could only be used as grounds for an appeal if they now were to do testing on it and it was exculpatory. And I want to make clear, too, like, there were, of course, there were people that were, like, just mad about bringing it. I had people tell me it's ridiculous for me to even suggest that this hair could be anything of any importance. I'm not saying that it is. What I'm saying is it could be, and we should know. Right. Like, that's the story of this entire case. The whole thing is, we don't know if Robert and Christian's alibis checked out because they never checked. They never looked. They never tried to find out. We don't know if this hair is relevant because it was never tested. It was never checked out. We don't know if the lighter was relevant because it was never tested. It was never checked out. The scenario I gave in the episode is just like, here's one way this could have went. You find DNA profiles on the socks. Everybody we know is excluded. Robert, Christian, I believe Ron, Javier, Jacob, they're all excluded as contributors from that DNA. So, okay, that very, in my opinion, very likely is your killer's DNA, but we don't know who it belongs to. They never run that through CODIS to see if they can find out who it belongs to. But then you also have this hair here. Well, how much more relevant would it be? Certainly, I think anybody being objective can agree it's not out of the question for Becky to have yanked a chunk of hair out of her attacker's head. That's not unreasonable at all for something to happen. It happens all the time in cases like this. But imagine if they had tested that for DNA. We still don't know who it is, but we know that that hair came from the same person that touched her sock. Now, how much more? Now, is there a case against Robert and Christian at all? Probably not. And then throw the lighter in. What if we find in the lighter, there's DNA there that matches one or either of those or both of those? You know, and I'm not saying that's the case. What I'm saying is we should know if that's the case. And I sincerely hope that the defense teams are working with the DA to do some DNA testing to get some of these answers.
Mm-hmm. Montana says, what would it have taken for the defense to do any testing on any items?
They would have had to have requested it. I don't know exactly how that process would work, but they should have been able. But the problem is, too, like, they don't know what all. Well, they do, because they get discovery at some point before the trial that tells them all the stuff that was collected. This file that we have is the discovery file. But yeah, I think they would have just had to request for the state to test certain evidence, and then that information would have to be brought up. But obviously they didn't.
Maury says, I think it's only very recently that hair could be tested without the root. Does this hair have roots? And if not, could that have factored into why it wasn't tested?
We don't know if it has roots. because all we have is one picture of it and a note in the report that it was there and a note that it was barcoded and put into evidence and it was never tested. So, but yes, there are, if not then, now you can do DNA testing without a root on hair. And that's one of the things that, like in the West Memphis 3 case that we're hoping, you know, would be nice if we could do some of that because there was hair testing done on some hairs. But they weren't able to get full profiles because they didn't have nuclear DNA on them or they didn't have a root. Well, now they can get full profiles. And on the topic of DNA, somebody, Bob in the chat said that, and this is another thing I keep hearing, was that my DNA expert said that you couldn't put the DNA from the sock into CODIS. And I've heard over and over again that it's YSTR DNA and you can't put that through CODIS. Some of the DNA was YSTR DNA, but as
Porphyria?
Yeah. As she notes, there was both YSTR and autosomal can be run through CODIS. There's no question about this. There are some of those profiles or rock solid profiles that have enough data to be put into CODIS. And the examiner that found the DNA at the bottom said that it checked the box. I have to make sure to say it checked the box and didn't write this. They checked the box that it is ready to be uploaded to CODIS.
Okay.
And they just didn't.
And as Jennifer pointed out in the Facebook follow-up chat, we don't even know if the hair was human or synthetic.
Right. We don't know anything about it. All we know is clump of hair.
Yeah, could have. Yeah. And it does look singed. It certainly looks singed to me. But again, that's just by eyeballing a photograph.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. It looked like part of it was singed. And that's why it's a huge deal. And again, it could turn out that it's nothing.
Right.
But this hair, it clearly wasn't. Like, in my opinion, is absolutely not from one of the victims. Just based on the color and length, you know it's not Becky or John's. Mm-hmm. Vicky, we have pictures of Vicky as blonde. We have picture of Vicky with brown hair. We have pictures of Vicky with her hair dyed red. So, you know, who knows if it could be Vicky's and it's longer. But we know that Vicky's hair and head, this did not come off Vicky's body. Right. Unless it was, like, yanked out in a struggle outside somewhere. My theory on it is found outside. It was close enough to the fire that some of it got singed, but it wasn't in the fire because it would have just been completely burned away if it was inside the house. And we see the conditions of the bodies that were in it. Well, I mean, you guys haven't seen the conditions. When you have entire legs and arms just burnt away, there's not hair left at the end of that process.
Understood.
So, you know, it could be. Is there a possibility that it could be maybe Vicky's if there was some struggle outside? You can't rule that out as a possibility, but to me, like, that's a huge find. Like, we have Becky, who in my opinion was the surprise here. I think Moore was pretty close in his, you know, I agree pretty much with what he said about how Becky came into this, which was they didn't know she was there. We talked about that months ago. And that if she, you know, she's missing the shoe, we don't know how she died. If there was a struggle, like, that could have been just laying right on the back porch, because you also see, like, there's not a bunch of debris and stuff on that, like, the paper, whatever they take the picture on. So I don't think this was sifted, right? So I don't think they took a clump of ash, wet ash, and sifted through and found this hair there. To me, it looks like that hair was probably, you know, somewhere out near that area in the north side of the house. But it was probably just laying on the ground, because, like, how would you see? It's black. And if you sifted it, it wouldn't stay in that clump together and it would be filled with debris. Like, I think it was probably found right there, like, in the area where I think the struggle with Becky happened.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, again, I can't or just can't really tell anything from the picture. It looks like it could be synthetic to me, but I know there was also a thread on Facebook mentioning that some killers are known to wear disguises, are known to disguise their appearances. And even just the evidence that someone was in disguise could potentially be interesting.
You know, if we test and find out it's synthetic hair, so be it.
Right.
But this shouldn't be a question. That's my point is this shouldn't still be a question in 2023, whether or not that was real hair or synthetic hair.
Yeah,
or who it belongs to, or if there was DNA on it. This shouldn't be a question now.
Yeah. Moving into the lighter, Sarah says, how dangerous is it to light gasoline using a lighter? I'm wondering what the chances are that the person might have gotten burned if they used a lighter like this to start the fire.
Well, you have to remember that the fire started with something, right? So you kind of narrow that down to a match or a lighter. One possibility is taking a match and just flinging it in there. And the other one would be would be a lighter. And there's several different ways that can happen safely. And that would be, pouring a trailer, which means, so you fill the house with gas and then you just like pour a little line of it to the outside. You light the very end of it. The fire runs in and explodes. Or using the lighter to light, say, a wad of newspaper or something else, or a stick to throw it in there. But there has to be, it doesn't have to necessarily be the thing that touched the fire to the gasoline, but somehow the fire had to start, and that's either with a lighter or a match. I think it's just as likely as one as the other.
Okay. Kate says about the lighter, Bob stated the police fire department kept people away from the scene, but didn't the neighbors get close to the house? Did Tim or the others smoke and just have them slip out of pocket?
I don't know. Again, it's a question that we could easily answer.
Right.
Before the police got there, the neighbors were all standing at the end of the driveway. And again, we don't know where the lighter was found. Was it 20 feet into the property? Was it 1 foot into the property? We don't know exactly where it was at. Uli in the chat says, what does processed material mean? The key was found in the processed material back there too. The processed material, I think, is the way I took it from reading the report is they were sifting through debris. They were putting all the stuff that they had sifted through or processed into kind of a pile behind the house. So that's what I took as processed material. I do have a picture. I should put the picture up of it, but because I saw like, it said they found two keys on a chain in the process material too.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty excited about that. I found it because I was thinking, is that Becky's car key? So it's not. It's like a long chain and then like keys to like a cheap lock, like you'd have, like a suitcase type lock,
mm-hmm.
something like that. It had two keys like that on it.
Okay.
Or could go to like a gun cabinet or something like that. I don't know, but those are like very clearly they're clumped up. There's debris on them. There's chunks on them. And that's something if you were sifting through ashes that you would find during the sift, unlike the hair. So that's the confusing part, Uli, too, is like with the hair, as I was just mentioning, like I certainly don't think it was like buried in a pile of wet, because remember that I've done this hundreds of times in my life. It's a shitty job.
Mm.
You know, when you're done, you have ashes and stuff that's all been soaked with water and it's wet and nasty and clumpy and you sift through it. You know, we're looking for electrical components and things like that to reconstruct the crime scene. In my opinion, there's no way that hair came out of something like that. I think it was, he said it was found back in the pile of process material. But I don't think that it was like sifted through in the ashes. I think it was just back there.
Regarding the socks, Veronica says, not related to the episode, but I saw a comment saying Javi's DNA was tested against the RNA on Becky's socks. We just talked about this. But Veronica didn't remember if that had been established and wanted to get that confirmed or denied. And then Karina weighed in and said she thought that it was the episode with the DNA expert. But I just wanted to toss this in there in case you knew right off the top of your head if that's...
Well, can you repeat the beginning of that a little bit?
Veronica saw a comment saying that Javi's DNA was tested against the DNA on Becky's socks. Veronica did not remember that being established and was looking for to be pointed in the direction of where that had existed, if it was in what episode it was in.
Yeah, I can't point you to... It was the episode or the follow-up after... when we had Susanna Ryan, the DNA expert, on, because in the report, when she was reading through it, it didn't show that it was compared to anyone. And then I think during the course of that next week, I found more documents and sent them to her. And that's where we saw that they had compared it to. So it is established. Robert, Christian, Javier, Jacob, all the victims, and I think Ron Friedley were all ruled out as contributors of the DNA and the socks. That was... Mm-hmm. That was established.
And was Bo also?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Pretty much everybody I think he was, because I remember saying that because of course people were like, well, that DNA must have been transferred from the, socks grab DNA from everywhere.
Right.
Which, is true, but not in profiles like that. And it's not certainly the most likely scenario of how that DNA got there. But I do recall like anyone we know that had been to that house anytime recently had been ruled out.
Yeah. But Teresa just brought up in the chat that it's, perhaps the keys could have been locker keys to Denny's if, in fact, they had lockers. That's an interesting idea.
It could be.
Idea.
For those of you that are in the live stream and anybody listening to this later can go check it out. But I will put the picture of the keys in the case documents for episode 59. I meant to do that, and I just forgot to put it in.
Okay. I'm going to just read part of Lana's comment, essentially saying, I'm just really struggling over this lack of testing the evidence. It just seems like such a crazy thing to not do. And this continues to raise concerns from Lana about something political happening here, kind of circling back to all the law enforcement connections in the case and wondering if there's a connection there between a lack of testing or a lack of work done and all of these different people at play and factors at play.
There are a lot of theories out there about, you know, corruption and people covering, you know, a cover up or covering for someone. That's the last place I want to go unless I have evidence of that happening. It seems like there was kind of a construed effort to kind of protect Javier. But I don't think that makes Javier guilty, right? So, his dad was worked in the DA's office. There was a whole thing about the immunity. And, of course, his mom was, which is a weird thing. I can't imagine that here, but it must have been a big deal there because everyone we talked to was like, Javier's mom was a politician down in the – like, it always comes up, you know? So, like, and people are like, you know, Bonnie Garcia's son. So, like, even with teenagers, always said, like, Bonnie Garcia's son. So it definitely seems like – I would put it this way. Javier had a support group. A group of people that support him that were actively trying to protect him. But I don't think that it just doesn't raise any red flags with me because I haven't seen anything to me to indicate that Javier had anything to do with this crime. So I think there may be a political angle that there's certainly a political angle about why this case got prosecuted at all. It was like re-election time and, you know, with Hestron and Zellerbach, there was all the stuff and the stolen campaign signs and all that. And people trying to solve this big case to get a big win. The cold case unit, like there was a lot of reasons for that. I just don't think that there was. I think LeClaire was an idiot, is what I think. Like, I don't think LeClaire was like, oh, well, we don't want to test that DNA because that could be this person or that person or this was an inside job with the police department. I don't think it was anything like that. I think he was just terrible at his job. My personal opinion, unless I see something to indicate otherwise that there's some kind of corruption to that level where there was like an intentionally hiding evidence at the beginning at the times when all this stuff should be. I don't think that he has the intellect to even plan something like that.
Just circling back to the people whose DNA was tested, Porfiria, I just wanted to clarify out of curiosity, Austin was never one of the people who was sort of on the radar for testing evidence.
I saw that and I don't remember.
I thought we talked about them taking his DNA and
he did. He
that
did.
They did. Yeah, they did get his DNA. But
yeah, and I don't want to say yay or nay to that because I don't remember off the top of my head if Austin's DNA was tested against the sock DNA or not.
Got it. Kathy says, if someone was able to pull up, I love this comment. Kathy says, if someone was able to pull up the weather/moon for that day and night, is it also possible to pull up reports from the fire department to see if they made any more specific notes about the make and model/year of the red truck, or to pull up vehicle ownership records for that time period and area, like the search for the white Elantra in the Idaho case? And then Kathy finishes with, I'm trying to establish my identity as the obsessed with the red truck lady.
I mean, certainly law enforcement could do things like pull up. First of all, no, I don't think there is any more information on the red truck. I mean, we heard Williams testify about it. We see his report about it. Like it's all red truck, white bed. I believe he said one person in it, smaller truck. That's all we know about it. Yeah, there's a world where law enforcement could. And again, that it doesn't have to be that complicated. It's not that big of a community. Like, what should have been, before they have to worry about any of that, like narrowing down who owns red trucks, they could have just knocked on the doors of the people that live in that community and asked them, hey, do you know who owns this truck? Have you ever seen a red truck with a white bed? It would have been that simple. And again, it's just a big drop ball.
Right. Chris W. says, Barbara Wright said she arrived home not long after the fire started. Did anyone report seeing her car? If no one saw her coming up the hill, isn't it plausible that neighbors didn't see anyone leaving?
Oh, right. And if nobody saw her car?
Right.
First of all, somebody else made a post about this on the fan page the other day that I keep saying there was no car that left the scene because nobody saw it. And then they had compared that to like, well, we know there was a red truck and nobody saw that red truck either. So I want to make clear, my point is, there's no evidence that anyone left in a car, right? You're working off a presumption of innocence. What evidence do you have that someone left in a car? No one said they saw a car. Also, it's kind of apples and oranges because the red truck, and I'm going to get back to Barbara Wright's car, the red truck was found or was spotted way down in the south end of the neighborhood, nowhere near the crime scene. It was headed in the direct, they say heading away from the crime scene. It was just, the crime scene was north of it and it was headed south. It wasn't like it was like, you know, zipping around the corner from the crime scene. And no one down there was questioned if they saw a car. So the only people that were questioned were the people that were alerted to the fire early and were headed to the scene at that time. And the immediate neighbors right there were the ones that were spoken to. Those people didn't see any vehicle. Now, Barbara Wright, she was heading towards the crime scene on the east side of the neighborhood and came up. She was on Alpine Drive for just to turn that quick little corner right there east of the crime scene. We don't know if other people saw her car because they didn't ask anyone if anybody saw her car. So when I'm talking about nobody seeing a vehicle up there, you have from like 9:40, according to the Captain Williams, on people that are looking like, oh shit, there's a fire. They're looking at it. They're calling 911. They're driving towards it, and no one sees a vehicle driving away from it. Nobody sees a vehicle driving on Alpine Drive, and I should qualify that too. No one says they saw a vehicle. Shockingly, what's never asked any of them in any of their interviews is, did you see a car leaving the crime scene? Did you see a car on Alpine Drive? None of them are ever asked that question. Now, I, common sense-wise, would think if there was this arson and triple homicide and you were there right at the beginning and you saw a car driving away from the crime scene, that you would mention, I saw a car driving away from the crime scene. I cannot imagine anyone would not bring that up if they had seen it. But the difference is with Barbara Wright, she's heading not away from, but towards a crime scene, way over on the east side of the neighborhood before anyone was alerted to the fact that there was a fire. No one was looking, no one was suspicious, and it certainly, I wouldn't think, would stick out in anybody's mind if they look out and see a fire and happen to see a car driving towards the crime scene and going to a different house.
Right. Fair enough.
Real quick, just to catch up with the chat, Montana is in the chat, wanted to know, is back to you, we're talking about DNA. She said, why did they go to a private lab for DNA testing? Was there a wait if they had gone with the DOJ lab? Yeah, that was one of the weird things that were pointed out by, I think, Dolan and Moore, was the DNA stuff was taken to the DOJ lab. And then they said it was going to be like, I don't remember, 4 months or something or a certain amount of weeks. It was going to take a long time to get the DNA testing. So then they took it back and then sent it to a private lab, which took a long, I mean, they pulled sector data a year later. I'm not even claiming there's corruption. Like, oh, well, instead we're going to pay, because I don't think they knew who they wanted to arrest at that point. But it's a weird excuse. Like, oh, we don't want to wait 4 months for this DNA, so we're going to send it somewhere else and spend $10,000-$20,000 to have another lab do it. That still, we didn't get results back until about the same time we would have got the results back from the other place. And then also, we only got Becky's or the Friedley home phone record for 48 hours because it costs $150 a day, and we don't want to pay any more for that. Like, it's just a weird disconnect. But yeah, Montana, that was the reason they gave, was that it was going to take too long at the DOJ lab, so they sent it from they sent it to a private lab. And regarding the, you'd mentioned the moon thing, and a few people are talking about it wasn't the point of their question. But I do want to point out, too, when people were talking about the moon phases, because I saw a post on Facebook where people were regarding the car, right? Mm-hmm. They were talking about, somebody said, well, they would have driven with the lights off. There are no street lights up there.
Oh, you can't do that.
Yeah. There's no street lights up there. And somebody had had pointed out what the moon phase was. It's even more important to point out there was no moon. So regardless of what the moon phase was, moonrise was, at the top of my head, I want to say 4 a.m, maybe it was 2 a.m, but the moon was not in the sky at the time of the murders. So it was pitch black. No, and that's one of the reasons, again, like, even if headlights were off and it was just brake lights, they would stick out like a sore thumb up there because it was so dark if somebody was leaving. And then if your theory is, well, maybe it was Robert and Christian and they left and they just kept their lights off, Let's go back to that drive test time now when you have to drive out of that neighborhood in those roads in the pitch black with no headlights on.
Right. Yeah, if this was planned and anybody planning it knew the area and knew that, I would imagine that that person or people would build into their plan that they could not drive out of that site without it being an issue, and that you would sort of plan to not be in a car for at least some portion of the immediate vicinity around the house. But
yeah, and it's, and again, when you get back to like the red truck and even Barbara Wright, you have to understand where the Friedleys lived, where John and Vicki and Becky lived, was the almost the most remote area of that. So down where the red truck is seen, there are, I don't know, 50, 100 houses north of there. I don't know, 50, I'm guessing. But there's a bunch of houses north of there and a bunch of different roads and stuff. So to see a car headed south at that point wouldn't stick out in your mind because it could have come from anywhere, any one of those houses. But the crime scene is on the farthest north street on the north side of the road in the dead center away from other roads. It's way out there. So seeing a car driving down that part of Alpine Drive, there's like four houses. Look in the aerial maps. It is very different to see a car driving down Alpine Drive at 10 o'clock at night than it is to see one down by Buckthorn where that other car was seen.
Right. Valeria commented, "Something struck me when I heard Moore's summary of the Friedleys' escape plan. Quote, something goes wrong, you go out the window. Go out the back to the hills." Valeria says, "I went back to look at Drew's interview and she said she felt, quote, unsafe up there. And again, that the plan was to run toward the mountain or to a neighbor. What was this escape plan for? It makes no sense to me if there's a fire, either in the house or in the desert."
I don't know if this is something that was told to me, so it may not be accurate, or if it was that I read in one of the interviews, but my understanding in my mind was this went all the way back to the days when Ron lived there and he was a working police officer. And the plan was always like, if something happened because of Ron's connections to law enforcement and the fact that, you know, there's criminals that don't like him. Because remember the whole Trapini thing with the murder out there that he came to his house. They were, buying guns for, Tiffany had said something about him buying guns from him or storing guns from him. So my understanding was always that it had to do with that. Like if something ever goes down because of something related to Ron's work, then it's go out the window, go out the back, and then run back into the hills. Hmm. That was my understanding of it. But if somebody who has some time on their hand wants to search back through those interviews and see if you can confirm that. But that was my understanding of it.
Gotcha. Teresa says, Could either of the defense attorneys mention that there were previous charges that were dropped and point out the new or additional evidence that came in with this trial? They didn't have Jeremy Witt. I think the drive test by Bodmer and the cell coverage maps with the GAR device is what was new.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that. I mean, there's so many rules about even bringing up somebody's past offenses or anything like that, anything that might prejudice the jury. And I will say without searching through it that I can almost guarantee that they were not allowed to bring up the fact that the state had already dropped the case once.
Okay.
I seriously doubt that's the case.
Jason says, are we going to hear any of the defense team's private investigators interviews?
I don't have any of those interviews. What I have is the state's discovery file. The file that the state presented as discovery.
Okay. Valeria says, can you share a copy of the images/video reconstruction of the house made by Uli and Dylan?
Uli and Dylan and I are in a group chat on Facebook about when they were making that. And Uli brought it up last week and Dylan said that he could email it to me. I don't think I've seen that email, but I'll touch back on that again to see if we can get that. Because what he did is he put together like a CAD design of the house, and at least in the version that I think he was going to make it into like a movie. Because the version I had, you were able to like drag and move around to see like how the house was laid out based on what we can reconstruct based on drawings and the crime scene photos.
Okay. And then I just wanted to acknowledge that, there were people who really enjoyed you getting very angry in the episode. so they want you to feel free to do that. And In fact, Rosalind says, can we change the theme music to Y'all Gonna Make Me Lose My Mind by DMX? Because that's what rolls through my head every time Bob Ruff gets pissed and says he's going to lose it.
We were discussing this in the Patreon hour before this. There was a little, I don't think anybody caught the little clunks that I had in there. But I was writing the episode as in real time, as I was going through the materials, and I had found the report about the hair. Also, I want to give another, I have already, but a big shout out to Valeria again, because Valeria just happened to, a week before, found the information about that lighter and brought it to my attention, is the only reason I ended up down this rabbit hole to begin with, because, you know, Moore in his cross, you know, says, you know, she grabbed that green, you know, they used that green lighter and started the fire. That jumped, like, I was like, oh, that's the lighter that Valeria was talking about. Had she not done that, there's a good chance the way my brain works, I would have read right past that and not just thought he was just making up a lighter. Not that they had actually found one on the scene. But so I was down that rabbit hole, found the report about the hair, and then wrote this whole thing about how we don't know anything about the hair, got way down further into the script, and then ran down that rabbit hole and found like the picture of the hair and all that. And so everything from the first moment I mentioned the hair until like that next break was not in the script. That was just me finding it and just going off about it, which it was, you may note me going, that hair, the most logical thing is it could be Becky's. And then a little while later, you hear me going, it can't be Becky's. It's because of the order of when I wrote it and when I just kind of lost it. So anyway, it definitely makes me want to lose my mind too. Every single day of this case is killing me.
I know. Anyway, so that's what I have for this week. Thanks, everybody, for all of your amazing feedback. The one thing that we did want to make sure we did not miss, and thanks, Jennifer and Valeria, for making sure I remember this, is that we did want to wish Robert Pape a very happy birthday, as happy as you can experience one if you are in prison for something you didn't do. If that's biased, sorry. I feel like we've already established that that is the point of view of this podcast.
Yeah, and so his birthday was yesterday, right, which when you're hearing this was Tuesday. And look for Valeria on Facebook if you want to, because she's helped organize some messages from listeners and stuff to send to Robert. So, all right. So that is all we have for today. We're going to wrap things up. Make sure that you tune in on Sunday when we're going to finally wrap up the trial. We get the final word heard by the jury, which was the state's rebuttal by Aki. And it's a little bit different presentation than you're used to. You're going to get the full context of everything that Aki said to the jury before they went in to deliberate. Tune in on Sunday for that. Everybody, make sure you tell Zach to get well so that he can be back next week.
Yeah, get well soon, Zach. We miss you.
Yep. And we'll see everybody. Love all you guys. Thank you guys all in the YouTube chat and for your Facebook question. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Kelly Barons Brink, and all music for the show was created by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by me, and all of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Viola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found in all forms @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney. And Zach is @Z2TheQ. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. As for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
So I'm going to go ahead and do some hot, hot improv, and we're going to see how this goes. We'll see what he brought to the table. I was doing so well. Kelly, that is when you come and you get yourself like your own boogeyman, right? That's usable, huh? And when we come back, we'll see what Mr. Moore, Esquire, the lawyer. What's happening? What's happening? Where am I? What's happening to me?